Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, our own Chapel Hill neighbor, Jody Manis, is the Keenan Distinguished Professor for Teaching Excellence in Early Judaism at UNC Chapel Hill. Jody, have I got that right?
Just about? Yes, you did. Thank you.
We about got that right. Now, she's developed a worldwide reputation as an archaeologist, and there's lots of interest in her work, especially last summer's findings at Hukok.
Yes.
In Israel. And there was a lot of things that happened. The thing that got a lot of attention was the discovery on the floor of an excavation of an old synagogue of some beautiful mosaics. And Jody, I've heard you say, this is great, but don't forget what else we found. tell us about how you happened to be digging and sweeping in Israel last summer.
Yeah, wow, what a big story you've asked me. And you can't ask an archaeologist anything better than to talk about their excavations. So thank you. Let me just backtrack and explain why I'm working at Hukok, and then I can talk a little bit about our discoveries there. So I am an archaeologist. I specialize in the archaeology of Palestine, that is ancient Israel and the surrounding areas, in the Roman and Byzantine periods. So chronologically, we're talking from about the time of Jesus and up to the Muslim conquest of Palestine in the 7th century. And one of my fields of research interest is ancient synagogues, not antique synagogues, but ancient synagogues.
What's the difference?
Well, not, for example, medieval period or early modern mm-hmm. period synagogues, but really ancient from the Roman period. Synagogues that date to about the same time that Christianity was on the rise and about the time Christianity first becomes
legalized. So when we read
legalized.
In the New Testament about Jesus going to the synagogue, you're looking
right.
at those kinds of synagogues.
That roughly, yes. That and in
and,
the centuries
and then
following.
Later on.
That's right. Exactly. And so the synagogues that I'm particularly interested in are the synagogues that were built by Jews at about the time Constantine legalized Christianity in the Roman Empire, that is in the 4th century AD or CE, and in the 2 or 3 centuries following that. And it's very interesting to look at how Jews constructed and decorated their synagogues at the same time that Christians began to build monumental church buildings decorated with very specific decorative programs. And that's one of the things that I'm particularly interested in. So the context of Judaism against the backdrop of the rise of Christianity. And so as part of this research interest, I came to realize that I needed to excavate my own synagogue building in order to answer a number of specific questions that I had about these synagogue buildings in
this
period.
So this is a mixture of history and the physical framework.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. It's using archaeological evidence, which are the physical remains that we dig up out of the ground, in connection with or in conjunction with the information that we have with various literary sources, in order to better understand the past. Because here is an opportunity to get additional information that gives us a slightly different perspective from what we might read in literary sources. So as a result of deciding that I wanted to excavate my own synagogue
building.
Well, how
do you get your own synagogue?
Yeah, it's not so easy, actually. Well, I've worked in Israel, you know, all my entire career. So since I was 18 years old, I did my undergraduate degree at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. I've been working in Israel ever since. I have a lot of experience there. I know pretty much everybody there. They know me. So it's not like I just suddenly appeared out of the blue, completely unknown, wanting to come and excavate an archaeological site. I have, of course, an academic record. I have credentials.
So you got the these things are the sites are not sold. They're allocated.
No, they're not sold. That's right. In Israel, there is a government body, an authority called the Israel Antiquities Authority, which oversees all archaeological work in the country. So anybody who wants to conduct an excavation in Israel has to apply for a permit through the Israel Antiquities Authority.
Well, how did you hear about Hukok?
Well, so what happened is after I realized that I wanted to excavate a synagogue, I had to find one, which wasn't actually so easy. I knew that I would be looking specifically at the area of Galilee because the type of synagogue building I'm interested in is located in Galilee, typical of Galilee. So I spent a couple of summers with an Israeli colleague visiting various sites in Galilee that had been previously documented by other archaeologists. That is, other archaeologists had gone and had walked around and had noted on the surface of the ground that you could see remains that looked like they might be synagogue buildings. And after visiting all these various sites, decided that Houkouk looked like the most promising candidate and the best candidate for finding a synagogue of the type that I was interested in.
And is the type you're interested in defined primarily by the years that it was occupied?
Partly by the years, partly by the style of decoration, the layout of the building. So various features characterize. It's what's actually called a Galilean-type synagogue. But not all synagogues in Galilee are Galilean-type synagogues. They don't all have this particular layout. But it is a type of synagogue that's found only in Galilee. And that's what I was looking for specifically.
Looking back, remind us what purpose a synagogue served.
That is a great question. And this is part of the reason why it's so hard to pinpoint the origins of the synagogue as an institution. Because the word synagogue originally refers not to a building, but to the congregation. In other words, literally, a synagogue is an assembly or gathering of Jews. Jews gathering together for the purpose of the reading and the study of the Torah. That's the five books of Moses, which contain biblical or Jewish law. And in antiquity, as a Jew, you lived your life according to the laws in the five books of Moses. So synagogues actually start as gatherings of Jews, assemblies of Jews, mainly on the Sabbath and festivals, where they would congregate together and have the law, the five books of Moses, or parts of the five books of Moses, read to them and explained to them so that they could live according to those laws, following those laws. So it's very hard to pinpoint the origins of the synagogue because originally there is no building that accommodates these assemblies. Jews could assemble and congregate anywhere. And in fact, even today, synagogues can meet in buildings that are not purpose-built as synagogues. I mean, I know of synagogues that meet in churches, for example. Even until today. So at some point, Jews started to build purpose-built buildings for these assemblies,
and same as churches.
That's exactly right. The early church, of course, meeting in the Domus Ecclesia in private houses,
or even
right?
today, starting out in a school building.
Absolutely,
or a storefront,
exactly the same thing. So it's only when you begin to get purpose-built buildings to accommodate these assemblies that we can then begin to identify them in the archaeological record. Now, this happens actually before the period that I'm exploring in my dig. My dig is exploring the late Roman period, so 4th, 5th, 6th centuries AD or CE, whereas the earliest synagogue buildings that we've been able to identify conclusively in the archaeological record do go back to about the time of Jesus, 1st
well,
century BC, 1st century
AD. Back into the New Testament framework the Nazareth in Galilee where we read that Jesus went into the synagogue and read from Scripture.
Yes.
Maybe not Torah, but from prophetical works. would this likely have been a building? Would there, at that period in time, there would have been?
There were purpose-built synagogue buildings already in this period. That is, 1st century BC, 1st century AD. It doesn't mean that every time a synagogue is mentioned in the New Testament, they're actually referring to a purpose-built building as opposed to a congregation or gathering. But we do have purpose-built buildings, but they're not easily identifiable in the archaeological record because they haven't yet developed many of the features that we associate with synagogues, the distinctive decoration, a specific place to house the Torah shrine, the Torah scrolls, features like that, liturgical furniture, that develops later. So these early synagogue buildings are really pretty basic halls of assembly. And therefore, a lot of times they're hard to define or to identify in the archaeological record, even if we have their remains. Sometimes we can't conclusively identify them as a synagogue building.
We're visiting with Jody Magnus, a distinguished archaeologist who lives among us here in Chapel Hill. She and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Keenan Distinguished Professor Jody Magnus, who is not only a member of the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill faculty as a teacher and researcher and mentor to graduate students, but also is an archaeologist who's achieved nationwide, worldwide notice. I guess that's a great reputation. And Jody, we're focusing on your work in the summertime and the archaeological digs at Hukok in Israel. And you were, you know, I got you off on a little bit of a tangent, which is so interesting, about why you wanted to dig up this synagogue in Hukok and what set it apart from other places. Maybe I ought to ask you, so what were you looking for and what did you find?
Right. So I was looking for a particular kind of synagogue building called a Galilean-type synagogue, which is characterized by a certain type of layout and a certain type of decoration, certain architectural and decorative style. And the real reason I was looking for one of these to dig up myself is because other synagogues of this type have been excavated elsewhere in Galilee, and I think that many of these buildings have been dated too early by the excavators. So the sort of consensus dating of this type of building is 2nd to 3rd centuries A.D., and I think they date to the 5th and 6th centuries A.D.
Now, what would be the difference in why would they be different in these different eras?
It would be the same. It would be the same building. The question is whether this type of building dates earlier or later. And the earlier dating is based mainly on stylistic considerations. That is, people look at the way that these buildings are laid out and the way that they're decorated, and they compare them to other buildings in the area and say that they most closely resemble other monumental buildings of the 2nd and 3rd centuries.
And so
my later date is based on archaeological evidence, that is the pottery and the coins that are found under the building in association with its construction.
All right, so let me try to and then you correct me.
Yes.
But I mean that the difference of opinion among informed people would be that you would say, look, here's a building, it might look like something that was a monumental building in the 2nd and 3rd century, but actually look what's there.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the clues from
a
later time, whereas your colleagues who would disagree with you would say, no, you got to be fixed on how the building is built. Maybe the kind of evidence that you'd find other than the solid rocks of construction are, you could have been salted, or
something like that. Right. So they say, well, maybe some of these buildings were built earlier, but were rebuilt later, or things like that. And the fact of the matter is, in an archaeological excavation, if you do have evidence of reconstruction like that, you would find it as you're digging. And in the excavation reports, the published reports of these excavations of other Galilean-type synagogues that I've gone through, I haven't seen any evidence of that kind of earlier building and then later reconstruction. It all looks like, to me, like these buildings were built, in fact, in the 5th and 6th centuries. And the reason why this matters, people might wonder, well,
tell us why it matters.
Well, the reason why it matters is because it would place these buildings in an entirely different historical context. So 2nd and 3rd centuries, we're still talking about the pagan Roman world. If it's the 5th and 6th centuries, we're talking about Jewish communities living under Byzantine Christian rule. That is, as a minority population under the rule of a Christian majority and a Christian government that is generally perceived of as being hostile to the Jews. And so it would make a big difference in our understanding of the relations between the Jews of Galilee and their non-Jewish neighbors. And that's why it's so important.
So there's an idea. This is what I was learning a little bit about history. There's an idea that by the time that the Christians took over the Roman government, they used the government to put a damper on other religions, including the founding religion, so that they said, no, we're not going to tolerate, or we're not going to encourage, or we're going to smother expressions of Judaism. And
Something like that. Yeah. I mean, what you find is, from the time of Constantine's legalization of Christianity, and it becomes the official religion of the Roman Empire in the 4th century, from that point, indeed, there is increasing hostility, at least if you read historical documents, legislation, Roman imperial, later Roman imperial legislation, increasing hostility towards the Jewish population of the empire, restrictions on the practice of Judaism. Jews are no longer, for example, allowed to acquire non-Jewish slaves, basically trying to prevent the expansion of Judaism. And among this legislation is legislation, and these are laws that were actually reissued several times, laws preventing or prohibiting the building of new synagogues.
Oh, and throughout the empire.
Yeah. But well, now, these are laws that are issued from the government in Constantinople, so which is modern Istanbul. So, you know, the question is, in fact, does the archaeological picture, does the picture we get from the archaeological remains back this up, or does it prevent
so you
present
think,
something
well, I mean,
slightly
what,
different?
The Hukuk digs may show that notwithstanding this edict or this rule that within Galilee, it was possible to build a new synagogue.
Yes, and not only. We actually have, I believe, and I think most archaeologists would agree, we have synagogue buildings that are built throughout the Roman world, not just in Galilee, in the 5th and 6th centuries. And in fact, the largest synagogue building that was ever discovered in the entire Mediterranean world is at Sardis on the western coast. Well, not coast, but Western Asia Minor, Western Turkey today. An enormous synagogue, which the excavators dated to the mid 4th century. I actually think it's 6th century, but never mind. It's still in this period that we're talking about. So, so we do outside of Galilee, but putting these Galilean type synagogues, which are really monumental buildings, they are large, conspicuous buildings. So saying that Jews, the Jewish communities of Galilee, you know, built these really big, conspicuous buildings in a Byzantine Christian context rather than a pagan Roman context, it really does change our understanding of what's going on in Galilee and the relations between the Jews and their non-Jewish neighbors.
Well, I want to ask questions a little bit off the topic. And we're talking about monumental buildings and how they might differ in different times. So I'm curious about how synagogue buildings, which are influenced by the monumental architecture of the times, how they would differ from the Christian churches that were being built in the same region.
Right.
And can you tell the difference?
That's a great question too. And so one of the things that I think is a result of all of this research on synagogues and my belief that many of these buildings are later than they're typically dated is that in fact what we see is I hate to use the word competition because it's so loaded, but let's call it a dialogue in a way between Judaism and Christianity. That is, in the 4th century, Constantine legalizes Christianity, and for the first time, Christians are allowed to worship openly and without fear of persecution. And so the earliest monumental church buildings that we have go back to the time of Constantine. They begin in the 4th century and they go on. So from that point, Christians start to build big monumental church buildings.
Before that, did they build buildings?
No, they couldn't be, not openly. They, mm-hmm. they could only
These
worship
were worshiping
in secret.
In houses.
That's right. They had to worship in secret because they were persecuted. Christianity was not a legal religion, a recognized legal religion in the Roman Empire before the time of Constantine.
But Judaism or
Judaism was. Practice, yeah, huh. Judaism was. The Romans recognized Judaism as an ancient, what they called an ancestral religion. They did not recognize Christianity because they considered it a new religion. And that was the way the Roman world worked. Mm-hmm. That's a Roman mindset that goes off into a completely different tangent.
Well, it's the grandfather clause.
It isn't the grandfather. Mm-hmm. It has to do with the way the Romans perceived of deities, the way they perceived of gods. And so anyway, you couldn't invent new gods in the Roman world. Either gods existed or they didn't. You didn't have new gods. And so
this is fascinating, but I got you.
You keep going, but I'll get you off track.
So what
I think is that, you know, when Christianity, when Christians start to build these monumental church buildings decorated with all sorts of decorative programs, you go inside their mosaics, their wall paintings, and so on and so forth, which broadcast the Christian message. And what is the Christian message? Basically, what Christianity did was to appropriate for itself the Israelite heritage, the biblical heritage. They laid claim to that heritage, and they were the new Israel, and they were the fulfillment of the Old Testament, right? The New Testament is the fulfillment of the Old Testament. If you believe in Jesus, this has superseded, right, biblical Jewish law. And, well, of course, the Jews rejected that message.
Well, some did, some didn't.
Well, okay, the Jews who stayed Jews rejected that message. And so what you find, I think, is Jews in a way responding to that challenge by building their own synagogues, which have a program which is distinctively Jewish, which is the Jewish sort of response or the Jewish message, so to speak, which focuses not on Jesus and the New Testament.
This is so
and
interesting
so on.
Because, yeah, and I'm keep coming yeah. back to modern times, but that you would see that a modern synagogue would be would have distinctive features from an established church building, but it would be influenced.
Of course, exactly. And so it's all, that's exactly right. So broadly speaking, I think what we see, and you see this in actual synagogue building layouts, you see that there is a lot of overlap with churches. So in the way the building is laid out and decorated, there are a lot of similarities, but there are also distinctive differences. So the difference would be, for example, in liturgical furniture. So in a synagogue, you would find the direction of prayer is towards Jerusalem, whereas in a church, of course, they're not praying towards Jerusalem. And the Jerusalem-oriented wall, the wall facing Jerusalem, typically has one or more platforms where they had the Torah shrine. That is, they had a little cabinet for the Torah scrolls, which, of course, are the focus of worship. And the focus of the Jewish service the synagogue service has always been the reading of the Torah, the reading of the five books of Moses. Whereas in a church, at the end of the hall, and in early churches, the orientation is typically east, but not always. At the end of the hall, you have a semicircular niche, what's called an apse typically, where you have not a Torah shrine, but an altar for the Eucharist, right? So the liturgical furniture differs. The decoration inside often differs because the message is different. So in synagogues, a lot of the decoration focuses on the Jerusalem temple, whereas in churches, of course, it focuses on Jesus and other New Testament figures. So those kinds of elements differ, but broadly speaking, of course, there are a lot of similarities.
Well, so that as a part of the architecture or the decoration in a synagogue in the times that you're working on, there is a memory of the temple? Is it
absolutely in synagogues? Absolutely.
Yeah, and how does the temple's gone.
Right. The temple's gone, but you know, today, 2,000 years after the destruction of the Second Temple was destroyed in the year 70 AD. 2,000 years after the destruction of the temple, it is hard for us to, even for Jews today, most Jews, to imagine the impact that the destruction had on Judaism at that time. And we forget that for centuries, literally, after the destruction of the temple in 70, that Jews literally lived in daily anticipation of its rebuilding. That is, today, you know, most Jews don't sit around thinking, oh, let's have the temple rebuilt. If that did happen, it would radically transform what Judaism has become now. But that was not the case in the centuries after 70.
It was like the Christians looked for the second coming. The Jews
that's
were
absolutely
were waiting
right. That's
for the,
exactly right. The Jews, the Christians were anticipating the second coming, and the Jews were anticipating not the second coming, but the rebuilding of the temple. And in connection, by the way, with the rebuilding of the temple, the arrival of a Messiah, because of course they did not accept Jesus as the Messiah. So the temple would be rebuilt when the Messiah came, right? So there would be a Messiah and the temple would be rebuilt. And this is what the Jews anticipated. And these are the messages that you see in synagogues, in the decoration of synagogues. And that's actually exactly what we see in our synagogue at Hukok. We are seeing these messianic expectations expressed in the decoration of our synagogue building.
Let's take a break and come back and talk about that. We're visiting with Professor Jody Magnus. We're talking about her archaeological exploits, and we'll continue that conversation after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, continuing my conversation with Kenan Distinguished Professor Jody Magnus about her archaeological work in Israel. Primarily now, Jody, don't let me get you off track again. let me get us off track, because we're getting ready to talk about what you've done at Hukok in Israel. And in the context of what you've... What did you find?
So we've now dug... for three seasons at Hukok. Each of our dig seasons is 1 month in the summer. And I should just mention that I do take students to dig.
Now, we found out how you got a license to excavate. How does a student get licensed to go excavate with you?
Right. Well, I offer the excavation for credit through UNC Study Abroad. And so undergraduate students, and they don't need to have any prior archaeological knowledge or experience, because this is a field school. They get fully instructed while they're on the dig. So they can sign up for the program through UNC Study Abroad, and they get academic credit for participating.
So how much credit do you give them?
They get 6 credits for one month of excavation. It's a really good deal. And as part of the program, we also do field trips around the country to other archaeological sites and to other sites of interest. So it's a complete program for the month of June.
What do you have them do work-wise then?
Oh, they do everything work-wise. So a lot of people don't realize how hard archaeology is. So a lot of it is basically working with big tools. People think of archaeologists as working with little, you know, dental tools.
Yeah.
And we do that sometimes. But a lot of the work is with big tools. So picks and shovels and hoes and carrying dirt and wheelbarrows. So it's very physical labor. It's hot. It's in June in the Middle East. So it's not easy. But it's also very, very rewarding and very exciting. And then we do also have places where once we, for example, start to come down on things like mosaics or wall plaster, of course, we start to work with very fine tools. So the students are fully instructed in all of that, and also in recording techniques. They get in the lab work. They get fully instructed in all of the aspects of the excavation.
Now, talk about the finding of these.
Right.
Talk about the mosaics.
Yes.
And then tell us about the whatever excitement there was that.
Yes. I have to say that in advance of the dig, I had not anticipated finding a mosaic, because Galilean type synagogues typically don't have mosaic floors. The canonical type has flagstone pavement. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of exceptions that have mosaic floors, but it's not something that I was expecting to find. So our very first summer in 2011, we did not come down on the floor yet, but we did find the wall of the synagogue. We found a small section of the wall, and we then continued digging next to that section of the wall in the summer of 2012. And once we dug inside the wall, in one square, which measures 4 by 4 meters, that's about 12 or 13 feet square, we came down on the synagogue floor, and it turned out to be paved with mosaics. And the very first mosaic actually was discovered by a student who had never been on a dig before and had never studied archaeology. And he was hoeing through the dirt, and his hoe clinked on something. And he got very excited, and he came, you know, he called me over. And I brought a little paintbrush, and we brushed it very gently, and we could see a mosaic with the face of a woman peering out at us through the dirt.
Wow.
And immediately, everybody started coming running from all the other excavation areas. And then what happened is I shut down the square, closed it off, and we called our site conservator. So there's a specialist who very carefully conserves these sorts of delicate things that we find, called the site conservator to come, and she was the one who exposed the rest of the mosaic and then took care of strengthening and preserving it for us. And so we continued excavating in that square, and we actually ended up finding 3 patches of mosaics. One is a decorated border running along the inside of the wall. The second goes with the face of the woman that we first found, and what we found there is an inscription in Hebrew, flanked by faces of 2 women, and we do not know the identities of these women.
But now, can you read
the inscription is legible, but it's not completely readable in the sense that you can make out the letters, but the full inscription is not preserved. We have parts of it. And so you can read the letters that are preserved. You can make out some of the words, but you can't fully read the inscription because parts of it are gone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it looks like a dedicatory inscription that refers to rewards for those who do good deeds, who fulfill the commandments. That's what it looks like. And so that was the inscription, flanked by faces of these 2 sort of enigmatic women. And then in the 3rd patch of mosaic that we found in the square, it's very fragmentary, but there's enough of it to leave no doubt that what we have here is the scene of Samson and the foxes. And this is an episode that's related in the biblical book of Judges 15, where Samson takes revenge on the Philistines by taking 300 foxes and putting them in pairs, tying their tails together, putting lighted torches between the tails, and setting them loose to burn down the fields of the Philistines. Seems like an awful lot of work to go to punish the Philistines. But anyway, that's
what they didn't have matches back then.
So that's what he did. And our mosaic shows pairs of foxes with their tails tied together and lighted torches between the tails, and then part of the figure of Samson next to the foxes. And so that's what we found in the summer of 2012. And then this past summer, we opened up a couple more squares to the north and south of the square that I just described. And in the square to the south, we found another Samson scene. This one shows Samson carrying the gate of Gaza on his shoulders. This is an episode that's related in the book of Judges 16, where Samson goes to Gaza to find to find a prostitute, basically. And the people of Gaza decide that they're going to ambush him, and they lay in wait for him during the night, and they wait for him to come out in the morning. And what he does is he fools them by getting up at midnight, and he goes out at midnight, and he pulls up the gate of Gaza, the gate of the city, and he puts it on his shoulders, and he carries it to Hebron. And our mosaic literally shows Samson as a giant figure carrying the gate of Gaza on his shoulders. And we found another mosaic, actually, further to the north, so to the north of the first mosaic that we found in 2012, where we have a very enigmatic panel that includes what appears to be a battle scene with elephants. And my staff are convinced, and I think that they're right, actually, that what we have here is a scene connected with the Maccabees, the stories of the Maccabees. Mm-hmm. The Maccabees...
They didn't have elephants, did they?
Well, they didn't... the Maccabees didn't have elephants, but the Maccabees, who are the Jewish family that is associated with the holiday of Hanukkah, they're the ones who led the revolt against Alexander's Greek successors. The stories that developed around the Maccabees involve elephants because the Greek kings who the Maccabees fought had elephants in their
armies. These were on the other side.
That's right. And so there are numerous traditions that sprung up after the Maccabean revolt about the Maccabees and their battles and martyrdom accounts of the Maccabees and other Jewish families that involve elephants. And there are no elephants, on the other hand, in the stories of the Hebrew Bible. So we think that what we have here is likely, if you're thinking about something in Jewish tradition that involves battles and elephants, we think that what we have here is something connected with the Maccabean martyrdom traditions. And if this is the case, it would be the very first time an ancient synagogue has ever been discovered that is decorated with an apocryphal scene. And when I say apocryphal, I mean a scene from a story that is not included in the canon of the Hebrew Bible. First and Second Maccabees are included in the Catholic Bible, but not in the Hebrew Bible or the Protestant Bible.
This would come out of the Apocrypha.
It would come out of those traditions that were circulating, and some of those traditions then get included in canons of certain religions, but not in others.
Well, when did they start? When, you know, I hadn't really associated mosaics with Hebrew or Jewish traditions.
Oh, right, right.
You know, comes from someplace else. When did the synagogues or Jewish construction start using mosaics? Is this ancient?
Oh, sure. The Jews were part of this Greco-Roman world, and it was very common in the Greco-Roman world to decorate especially public buildings, but not only. I mean, if you were wealthy and you could afford it, you might have mosaics decorating your house. So the Jews, just like everybody else, decorated their public buildings.
Just like
buildings
people at Pompeii.
Absolutely. Yeah. And in fact, in the time of Jesus, in the wealthy houses of Jerusalem, we have beautiful mosaic floors. And Herod the Great decorated his palaces with beautiful mosaic floors.
Well, I want to talk about this forever, but we need to take a break and then come back, and I want to talk about your stardom in theater.
Oh, okay.
Can we do that? I'm visiting with Professor Jody Magnus. She and I will be right back.
Chapelboro.com is more of what you live here for. If it's happening where you live, you can find it on 97.9 FM, WCHL's website, Chapelboro.com.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Keenan Distinguished Professor Jody Magnus, and we've been talking about her digs, summer digs. I want to talk about the film, but first... just a minute more about the digs. And that's what are you going to do in the summer of 2014?
We're going back in June to continue excavating. We will be opening up new squares in the synagogue. And we will also be continuing, I don't ever get to talk about it, but we are excavating not only the synagogue, but also part of the ancient village, which is another area on the site. And we are also excavating part of a modern village that overlies the synagogue building.
Now, Hukok is in Galilee.
Mm-hmm.
And, New Testament people, this is like Nazareth is nearby.
And no, it's actually not near Nazareth. Yeah. Nazareth is
near
further
the Sea
to
of Galilee.
South. We're very close to the Sea of Galilee. We're about 2 miles inland from the northwest shore of the Sea of Galilee. So in other words, we're about 2 miles inland from Capernaum, which of course was the base of Jesus' Galilean ministry, and from Migdal, or ancient Magdala, which was the hometown of Mary Magdalene. So we were really right in the middle of the area that was the heart of Jesus' Galilean ministry.
Yeah, no, I can't
this
get off.
This is the landscape that Jesus wandered around.
You're tempting me, but we got to now talk about the film. Now, the National Geographic has produced an exciting film that's used taking advantage of all the high definition and the three-dimensional capabilities to show us Jerusalem, and they made you an important feature of this film.
Yes.
Can you first of all tell us about the film, and then if you will, if we got time, talk about your role in it.
Right. Well, the film is simply called Jerusalem. And if viewers are interested, by the way, we run out of time, they can go to the website, which is JerusalemTheMovie.com.
We'll do that, and I'll try to remember to put a little link up on our description.
That's great. And it's an IMAX film, so it's an IMAX format, so it's large screen, giant screen. And it is it's in a format that is it's the kind of film that's shown in science museums. So it's a 40-minute long film. It's not a commercial length film. Mm-hmm. It's a 40-minute long film. It will be showing in.
It's in beginning in February. It'll be available over at the Marbles Museum.
That's right, in Raleigh, and it's been showing in Charlotte since September. And it tells the story of Jerusalem as a city. So it's not a film about the history and archaeology of Jerusalem alone. It's the city of Jerusalem, the modern city of Jerusalem, but also including its history and archaeology. And in order to cram all of this into 40 minutes, what the filmmakers did was to tell the story of the city through the lives of three young women who were natives of the city, a Jew, a Christian, and a Muslim. And basically by exploring the lives of these young women and their families and their connection to the city of Jerusalem, the film then tells the story of the living city of Jerusalem. And my role in the film is to sort of convey the past, the archaeology, the history, and sort of the scientific components. So the only four people who appear in the film are the three young women and myself, and I appear as the archaeologist.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. And the film is narrated by Benedict Cumberbatch, who, by the way, I didn't get to meet, but he
well, you
is gotta narr-
tell us.
Narrated
some of
by
us
him.
Didn't. Some of us didn't know who
Benedict Cumberbatch is the guy who plays Sherlock Holmes, so he's pretty
he's
famous.
He's the star.
My students are all very impressed that he narrates the film, but they're disappointed that I didn't get to meet him.
You narrate a little bit of it, don't you?
I don't. It's not narrated. It's that that I have a speaking role in the film, so I'm shown on camera being interviewed, and then I'm shown sort of from a distance, and you hear my voice, and then there are a couple of places where you just hear my voice.
What, I've got the impression that you're just talking about the water, the tunnels and the water.
Well, partly, right? Yeah.
And partly. Why is that important?
Well, one of the things that the film asks early on is what is it that attracted people to live in Jerusalem? I mean, what is it? It's actually not, on the surface, Jerusalem is not an attractive place to live. It's a remote, isolated, fairly impoverished mountain town without a lot of natural resources. And so the what really attracted people to Jerusalem already 5,000 years ago is a perennial freshwater spring called the Gihon Spring. And the earliest settlement in Jerusalem is located next to that spring. So that's where that comes up in the film, early on sort of trying to answer the question, what is it that attracted people to Jerusalem? And then, of course, the big question, what is it then that makes Jerusalem special? Because lots of cities have water sources, but what is it about Jerusalem that sets it apart, that makes it so special for so much of the world's population?
Well, we just got a minute more, but one of the things that I've neglected to get you to talk about is your role as a professor at Chapel Hill. So what do? You teach, or do you do research, or do you become presidents of national professional organization? What do you do with your spare time?
What do I do? No, I don't really have spare time, but I mean, I do what I love. And so, I'm fortunate to be able to do archaeology for my living. I've wanted to be an archaeologist since I was 12 years old, literally. And so I'm very passionate about it, and I'm lucky to do it. But yes, I do. I teach undergraduate and graduate students. I advise those students. I publish. I dig. I'm involved in professional organizations, and so yes, all of that, right?
Well, look, Jody Magnus, thanks for taking time from that busy schedule to share some of the excitement of your work and what you're doing, and Godspeed this summer when you go back to Hukuok.
Thank you. And I also have a website. It's my name, jodymagnus1word.org.
We'll put both the website for the film and for your website on our site, but it's Jody
Magnus.
M-A-G-N-E-S-S .com.
.org.
.org.
I'm an organization.
Thanks, Jody Magnus. Thanks to all y'all for listening. This has been Who's Talking, D.G. Martin. I'll be back here before you know it.